had planned on telling you the world has changed. I wanted to say that we've become what one minister, Adam Stillwater, calls a distracted people. A people faced with so many things pulling on our attention and our resources, we can't possibly give adequate attention to any one thing. We struggle today to discern and appropriately attend to the essential facts of life. But then, as I was considering readings for today's service, I remembered the likely familiar words that Mark shared. Henry David Thoreau is one of a few Unitarians that most Americans have heard of. You may even know that Thoreau went to Harvard, though he didn't much care for the usual Harvard graduate professions. And so he spent much of his early years wandering, trying to find his place. It was March 1845 when the man considered the founder of American Unitarianism, William Ellery Channing, decided to intervene. "Go out and build yourself a hut," Channing told Thoreau, "and there begin the grand process of devouring yourself alive." "I see no other alternative," he said. "No hope for you." 2 months later, Thoreau began his great experiment in simple living along the shores of Walden Pond. Thoreau, as he writes, went to the woods so that he could live deliberately, drive life into a corner. It was 1845, and apparently, even back then, life required simplifying. So much for my claim about the world changing. Apparently, regardless of the age you live in, it has always been a struggle to discover what it is that truly matters and to hold your attention there. And yet, think of all that has been added to human life in these last 150 years. In the last 15 alone, the internet has profoundly increased our access to information and opportunity. Add to that things like automobiles and airplanes, telescopes and microscopes. I mean, surely if Thoreau struggled in 1845, before all these things, to tend to the essential facts of life, what hope is there for us to do anything close? Of course, the idea is that all these changes and their impact on society should actually make finding these answers easier, right? I mean, part of Thoreau's problem was that his options were so narrow, and none felt right to him. Since then, we've removed many of these limitations, and most of us have many, many choices for how we could make a good life today. So theoretically, today, it should be easier to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life. We have so many choices now, we should be able to discover and take the path that is truly and perfectly ours. Psychologist Barry Schwartz describes this positive take on our explosion of options as the, quote, official dogma of Western industrial societies. He defines this dogma in this way. If we are interested in maximizing the welfare of our citizens, the way to do this is to maximize individual freedom. The way to freedom is to maximize choice. The more choice we have, the more freedom we have. The more freedom we have, the more welfare we all have. Now, to me, this doesn't just sound like Western society's dogma, which I agree it does, but in many ways, non-dogmatic though we claim ourselves to be, it also sounds like the implicit dogma of our religious tradition. Freedom is good, more freedom is better. The way to more freedom, more choice. The path that will lead to the most good is the path with the greatest number of choices. Right? This is the philosophy that's at the root of Unitarian Universalist religious education programs for the better part of the last 60 years. We've given our kids lots and lots of ways to think about truth and religion and God or no God. And then we've said, choose for yourself. And there's a lot of good about this philosophy. But as our kids have grown up, some have wondered if it is only for the good. Our young adults often tell stories of times they've faced loss or disappointment, and rather than a religious anchor to turn to, they just had a lot of options. And all these extra options didn't really help them hold fast to what was ultimately worthy of their time, attention, and devotion. It just left them afloat in a sea of possibilities. Now, these stories mirror what we're learning in social research, which is that infinite choice does not necessarily lead to infinite goodness. It turns out that we humans like a certain degree of limits. This is exactly what Barry Schwartz discovered and reported on in his work, The Paradox of Choice. First, he says, too much choice produces paralysis. Just think about your local grocery store. For example, think about specifically the salad dressing aisle. He says, just on average, 175 options for salad dressing fill the shelves. Right? So you've been there, you're just staring. I don't know if you're like me, you're kind of trying to figure it out. And finally, you just give up and say, oh, I got one at home, it'll work fine. This choice paralysis extends far beyond groceries, of course. As Adam Stillwater describes, faced with too many choices, people today don't search for ways they can be involved. They focus on what they can avoid. The default answer is no, or at best, maybe. We're looking for subtraction, not addition. Second, Schwartz said, even when we do make a choice, we end up less satisfied than we would have been if we would have had fewer options. See, with a lot of choices, if your pick isn't totally perfect, which it never will be, then it's easy to imagine that you could have made a better choice. So you regret it, and you don't enjoy it, because you're obsessed about what you might be missing, even when your choice is terrific. And ultimately, when you are dissatisfied, there's no one to blame but you. After all, you had a million choices, and you chose wrong. So the end result is you're unhappy, and it's your own fault. I don't know about you, but this totally rings true for me. So many choices, so many things vying for my attention. However will I choose, and however not to be disappointed? As a religious community, one of our most critical tasks is to be that hut where the Thoreaus of today can devour themselves alive, and to help one another name and claim what really matters, and to act in response. A generation ago, the best way to do this was to offer our community lots and lots of choices in theology, spiritual practice, in programming, in ways to connect and grow and serve. But today, and in light of Barry Schwartz's research, our task has changed. We still must help each other discern and live meaningful lives. But we need to do so without compounding this problem of too many choices and information overload. We need to help each other subtract, not add. We need to offer focus, not another distraction. We need to give up some of our desires to go wide and instead help each other go deep. But how? I have 4 proposals for you to begin, and none of them are original. I mean, I already confessed these are my questions too, and so I've been doing a lot of reading and research on the subject. We'll need your ideas as well, things you're trying out. We'll need to discover this path with all our wisdom and ideas and our partnership. It's that big of a change. For it challenges some of our most basic assumptions about what it is that leads to a better life. So here, for your consideration, are my 4 ideas. Number one, margin. Now, we like to say that our worth is inherent. But the way most of us act, you'd think we believe we are made worthy by way of how busy we are. What if instead we helped each other embody this alternative value system that we claim and live our message that we are already worthy, already loved, even at rest? As a congregation, this practice might inspire us to create more intentional childcare swaps, or errand sharing, or other ideas to help each other find that greater margin in our lives. It definitely asks us to look at our church calendar as a whole, to leave our silos behind and instead coordinate and integrate our ministries. It asks us to assess the whole multiple committee meetings that Keith referenced, and to think again about how many times we ask folks, all of us, to show up in a given week, how we can combine some of our meetings and programs for all of our sake. Which brings me to practice number two, focus. What are those things that we, and only we, are meant to do in our own lives and as a religious community? What are our essential tasks? We need to focus and put our resources towards these things. Now, inevitably, this will mean that there's going to be stuff you love, but that isn't uniquely ours. These things can still happen, but they just don't get featured as centrally important. Not everything can be important, or nothing is. Too many choices leads to no choice at all. Third, vision. Now, I know some among us have been clamoring for some time for a new strategic plan for our congregation. We are, after all, in year 7 of our 5-year plan. This is one of the great opportunities of our upcoming interim period. It will be a time of deep discernment where we can consider where we have been and where we are going and what are the steps for arriving there as a religious community. This practice can also be applied individually. Where have you been and where are you going? And what 3 or 5 successive and simple steps can this religious community offer to help you weave together a life of meaning and purpose? These next few years invite us to cultivate this common vision and then align all of our ministries across the lifespan with these ideas. Finally, number 4. And this is one that this community, probably because of Mark's leadership, already gets and is teaching me, and that is joy. As in, joy is primary, central, and laughter critical. More important than any particular task, finding joy along the way keeps busyness from being too alluring. And in our individual life, this means play and sense of humor and taking our commitments but not ourselves too seriously. We're all doing the best we can, after all. And sometimes our attempts fall short, and we say or do dumb things. And in light of this, what can we do but laugh together and forgive? Enjoy. As a community in these coming years, I promise to hold fast to this important practice that Mark has clearly instilled here. My hunch is that it will require we get more intentional about rotating leadership and roles to prevent cynicism and burnout. And it will mean noticing, even as we are growing and changing, when our to-do list gets so big, we forget why we're doing this at all, which is something like to bring more love and goodness to this overly busy, distracted, and often overwhelming world. So these are my, or not really my, 4 ways to begin. Margin, focus, vision, and joy. Practicing these, we'll surely discover others. And through our practice and discovery, we will bring into being a new vision for ourselves and for our faith. A vision where setting limits means everything is actually more possible, and where setting clearer boundaries translates into a greater abundance for us all. This is mostly uncharted territory. And the only thing I know for sure is I'm glad we get to walk this path together. And so I say, blessed be, and amen.